You are. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago this week, when U.S. troops forced the Taliban out of its last stronghold in Kandahar, Afghanistan turned its hopes to a new day to reconstruction. The schools have opened. The kernel of a democratic government is in place. And earlier this week, interim President Hamid Karzai announced plans for a new national military. But question marks about Afghanistan's stability and prospects abound in this hour. On the eve of war with Iraq, what can we learn from the aftermath of the last war, the Afghan War? We begin in Washington with perspective on flaring tensions between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Revelations last week that donations made by the wife of the Saudi ambassador to the United States may have been passed along to two 9/11 hijackers has led to fierce criticism of the Saudis. Yesterday, in a rare and feisty press conference, the Saudis hit back. Ted Alden, Washington correspondent for the Financial Times, was there. I asked him, what has the Saudis so steamed?
They're upset about a number of things. They feel that they have been wrongly targeted, as in some way being the origin of the September 11th attacks. I mean, 15 of the 19 hijackers for the September 11th attacks were Saudis. And since that time, there has been a lot of tension in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And it's bubbled up periodically. It's bubbled up over questions of whether the Saudis are being sufficiently aggressive in going after wealthy individuals or charitable groups that have been supporting terrorist groups. There was a consultant to the Pentagon who some time ago said that really the U.S. should be looking at Saudi Arabia as a potential enemy because the religious ideology of the regime is such that it's inherently hostile to the United States. That infuriated the Saudis. There have been comments from U.S. religious leaders like Jerry Falwell and Franklin Graham denouncing Islam as inherently a violent religion, and that is, again, infuriated the Saudis. They've seen it as insulting of their faith. So there have been a whole series of things over the last 4 or 5 months that finally came to a head this week, and the Saudis decided that they were going to respond in a very angry and public way.
And now we have the foreign policy advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah, the Saudi leader in the United States. This is Adel Al-Jubeir.
That's correct.
He is just about as visible as you could be in the last day and a half. There was a press conference at the Saudi embassy in Washington yesterday, not something that normally draws much attention. What was the scene there?
The scene was rather chaotic. The networks were there. There were cameras lining the whole back. It was overflowing out of the room with reporters, and he really launched right into it. There was a substantive part of the press conference, which was they wanted to go out with a document showing their various contributions to the war on terrorism. But the deeper message was just how angry the Saudis are at these various criticisms. And he used very harsh language. He said that Americans have said things that have been insulting to the faith of Saudi Arabians. He said that some of the rhetoric out of the U.S. borders on hate. It was very, very angry language, and I think that surprised a lot of people. It certainly surprised me. I had expected the particular details on what the Saudis were doing in the war on terrorism. I had not expected that sort of visceral anger from him.
Mr. Al-Jubeir has been everywhere in the last day or so. Who is he? He's very conversant in American idiom and with the kind of underlying physics of American politics, it would seem.
He spends a great deal of his time in Washington. He is the official spokesman for the Saudi embassy here, but he is also the primary foreign policy advisor to Crown Prince Abdullah, which illustrates, of course, the tremendously important role that the U.S. plays for the Saudis. It's central to everything they do in their foreign policy. So he has excellent contacts at the highest reaches of the administration and a very deep understanding of the dynamics of American politics. And he used some of that yesterday. He sort of said his own long experience in the United States, he had never seen this sort of language about the Saudis being used before. So he tried to use his own personal experiences to make the general point about how upset the Saudis were by all of this.
The drip torture of the Saudis came to a head with news reports about the Saudi princess whose money may have found its way into the hands of some of the actual terrorists in the September 11th attacks. And the comments that came in the days following that, Joe Lieberman was right there, Senator Shelby. Were these the things that put the Saudis over the edge?
I think there were two things. I think there are real issues here about what Saudi charities and others have been doing in terms of deliberately or inadvertently financing terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda. And there are real concerns in the U.S. government about whether the Saudis are doing sufficient things to crack down on that problem. I think the story about the princess and this money, it's a rather convoluted one, and there is no evidence that she knew that this money would in some way find its hands into a couple of the September 11th hijackers. It's not even entirely clear it did. But that issue, I think, just for a lot of people up on the Hill, served to crystallize a lot of anger in the U.S. and feeling that the Saudis have not really been doing enough to crack down on this problem of the financing of terrorism. I think everything just came to a head. I think that was indeed the kind of final straw that resulted in a lot of angry response in the U.S., then finally persuaded the Saudis that they had to speak out on this subject. I do think substantively, though, they are genuinely worried that the United States may take tougher action to try to crack down on Saudi charities and others that are financing these terrorist groups.
And the problem in that for the Saudi leadership?
There is a real problem in that, because these charities, a lot of them are very big and very powerful. A lot of the individuals who are in high posts in these charities are wealthy and respected Saudis. And so that sort of action could cause a lot of embarrassment.
So between American anger and resentment back in Saudi Arabia, this puts the ruling family between a real rock and a hard place here. It seems like they're crying ouch, because the pain of spanning these two constituencies is getting intense.
It's tremendously difficult. There's a lot of sympathy in Saudi Arabia for Osama bin Laden, for al-Qaeda, even though the Saudi government obviously is very strongly opposed to al-Qaeda and very much a close U.S. ally. And so they're trying to straddle these two areas, I mean, maintaining their close alliance with the U.S., but not angering people in the kingdom who are actually rather sympathetic to al-Qaeda.
What about the politics, the agendas at work in Washington? Clearly there's outrage over some of the details, but are there other agendas at work? Are people trying to soften Saudi Arabia up to accept U.S. troops? Is there a deeper agenda at work here?
Well, I think for the administration, there definitely is a deeper agenda in wanting to keep some of this rhetoric a bit cooler, precisely because they need Saudi support, not just for basing rights for a war against Iraq, but particularly to increase oil production when oil prices begin to rise sharply if such a war breaks out. And so the administration really wants to keep a lid on this. I think there are a number of people up in Congress who are maybe less sympathetic to a war against Iraq, particularly Democrats who say the war on terrorism should be a priority. And they want to hit very hard at the Saudis. They want to make an issue out of this. In part because I think because it's embarrassing for the administration. This administration has got very close ties to the Saudis. George Bush personally, back in the days in which he was Texas oil man, has very close ties to the Saudis. This is a line of investigation that eventually could prove very embarrassing to the White House. I think there are definitely some political motives for pushing this. I think more genuinely, those who are determined to get to the bottom of what happened before September 11th say the Saudis are a part of this equation, and we're determined to pursue this investigation aggressively wherever it leads, and that's one of the places it leads. So I think those are really the two motives.
Through that prism, it looks like we may hear more about this, despite the outcry from the Saudis this week.
I think we're going to hear a lot more. And there, of course, you know, behind all this is this enormous lawsuit that's been launched by the families of the September 11th victims, you know, seeking $1 trillion from various Saudi businessmen and from Saudi political officials for their alleged involvement in the September 11th attacks. And that's got a long ways to run, so this is hardly going to be the last of it.
More shoes to drop. Ted Alden, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Ted Alden is Washington correspondent with the Financial Times. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. It's 1 year this week since U.S. and Northern Alliance forces defeated the Taliban, turning Afghanistan toward hopes of reconstruction. Millions of dollars have been invested in rebuilding the country's infrastructure, hospitals, and schools, but little has changed for the average Afghan citizen, says one reporter, fresh from the front lines, with fading hope and mounting frustration. On the eve of potential war with Iraq, last year's battlefield, Afghanistan, could again slip out of control. As another war front opens up, what lessons can we take from continuing instability in Afghanistan? And what does the Afghanistan story say about our ability to clean up the breeding grounds of terror? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from New York this evening is Michael Ware, correspondent for Time Magazine. He's just returned from a year of reporting from the front lines in Afghanistan. Good evening and welcome, Michael Ware.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us, and welcome. Well, welcome back from Afghanistan.
Yes, it's a bit of a pleasure to be back in the in the civilized world, can I say.
You're just a week or so out of that country, is that right? And you were there for most of the year since last year's combat.
Yeah, that's correct. I arrived in Kandahar, which is the provincial capital in the south of the country, in December last year, shortly after the fall of the Taliban regime and their retreat from Kandahar, which, of course, was their home base.
Michael Ware, you've been there, you've seen a lot. We want to hear your stories tonight. But at the conclusion of a story that you filed for Time magazine very recently, a story that asks, is the U.S. losing control of Afghanistan, was a line that just spun my head around. You describe the tea houses of Kandahar, and you say that the tea houses of Kandahar are filled with the voices of young Afghan men expressing their hatred for America. This is a far cry from the kind of throwing of flower petals that we were all regaled with this time last year. What's going on here? We didn't expect this to be Afghanistan one year on.
Well, there's a lot of disappointment in Afghanistan. There was high expectations by the people with the arrival of the international community, and particularly the Western military forces. Obviously, the Western military forces are primarily viewed through the prism of the US military. So this disappointment has grown considerably over the last year and is, in fact, peaking as we speak. So, yes, it's true. There are young men, old men, everyone in Kandahar is sitting around now questioning, well, what was the point? There's two things to remember. One is Kandahar was the spiritual home of the Taliban. It was from Kandahar from whence they sprang up. So it is always a deeply conservative part of the country. By its very nature, it is not prone to supporting the values and the agendas of the West. So to some degree, it's not quite surprising. Mm-hmm. However, in Kandahar, like the rest of the country, people did give some time. They sat back, they bided their time, they waited to see how things would pan out.
And what was it, Michael, that they were waiting for? When they say, what was the point, what was anticipated that hasn't arrived, that has people now perhaps turning sour on the USA?
Well, the short answer is an improvement in the quality of life. They believed that with the arrival of the West, that they would begin to see the manna from heaven falling, if I could say that. Mm-hmm. They expected to see roads being built, roads which were destroyed by the Russians, roads which were torn apart during the Mujahideen chaos in the early 90s, and roads which have subsequently been bombed by the US military. They're waiting to see their bridges repaired. They're waiting to see schools rebuilt, albeit schools for the boys. Mm-hmm. They're waiting to see irrigation channels. They're waiting to see health clinics and hospitals.
And are you saying that all those boxes remain unchecked? We hear about aid going into Afghanistan. Do they not have new roads? Do they not have some schools? Do they not have fruits of a year of American oversight?
I'd be reluctant to call the gains made so far tokenistic. However, they're extraordinarily limited, either by geography or by their extent. Well, for example, very little has been done to the roads. This is something that the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, is continually hammering the international community over. He obviously is calling for greater and greater aid at every opportunity, but his focal point is the roads. You start fixing roads, not only does that create enormous employment because it's so labour-intensive, such a massive construction as a road, but it also enables the freedom to travel, it enhances commerce, it starts opening some doors that have been closed or barely ajar for quite some time.
And a fairly fundamental issue in a country as rough and mountainous as Afghanistan. If you don't have roads, you're not going to get around much for commerce or anything else.
Absolutely. And it doesn't even have to be the back roads. I mean, there's back roads that I don't think anyone will ever get to fix. And, for example, in many of the more remote areas that I've travelled in, be it to meet with Taliban commanders, be it to pursue ongoing combat operations or get to the scene of US bombings, Some of these roads, really, it's a very generous description to describe them as roads.
Roads at all.
Michael
Ware, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about a slipping U.S. grip in Afghanistan 1 year on. How does the Afghan picture size up to our expectations? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
7633.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a slipping U.S. grip in Afghanistan. My guest is Michael Ware. He's Time magazine correspondent, recently returned from a year in Afghanistan. He has seen a lot. He's sharing it with us tonight. Do you remember the images a year ago? The goats being slaughtered, the rose petals being thrown, the celebration in Afghanistan at the banishment of the Taliban. It doesn't sound so great now. Is the U.S., is the West still committed to rebuilding this nation? And on the eve of war with Iraq, possible war with Iraq, what can we learn from the aftermath of war in Afghanistan? Are Americans, are you still plugged in to the Afghanistan story? Or have we bombed and run? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Ware, you write about a new... what you describe as a fear of failure among Americans in Afghanistan, even among American military brass in Afghanistan. This is not a word that we associate with U.S. military lately. What's the reason for this unease? What's the evidence of a fear of failure?
Well, I think the military realizes how precarious the situation is, especially in terms of security. Without security, you can't have reconstruction. And the security situation is deteriorating, can I say, both in terms of Al-Qaeda, former Taliban remnants, and other hostile militant groups, which are launching an increasing pace of attacks on U.S. military facilities and outposts and against the Karzai government itself.
And this is not just warlords? You're saying this is Al-Qaeda? This is terrorists?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's take, for example, the southeastern corner of Afghanistan. American Special Forces have what they call fire bases posted out in the hills where 30 elite troops will live. And from there, they will roam out, gather intelligence, arrest people, conduct small operations. Since June, these bases have been coming under rocket attack or mortar fire on average 3 times a week. Now, in the last 7 or 8 weeks, that tempo has easily doubled. These bases are now coming under regular attack. I remember shortly before I left, perhaps 2.5 weeks ago, 4 bases were hit in one night.
Who's doing the shooting? Who's firing on these bases?
These are militants and terrorists who are crossing the border from newly re-established training camps and terrorist facilities in Pakistan. As a U.S. military intelligence officer said to me, the Al-Qaeda camps that we came to Afghanistan to destroy have simply packed up and moved east.
So you're not using this terrorist term loosely here. You're saying these are men associated with the very terrorist group that the U.S. came to push out.
Without a shadow of a doubt. There is two types of instability in security terms in Afghanistan. There is the regional factional fighting, there is general warlordism and banditry. Then on the other hand, you have a far more politically directed form of violence and instability, a far more militaristic kind of assault on the entire society and the Western military forces there. You can clearly identify the two different types. And there is enormous evidence to show that not only is Al-Qaeda present in Pakistan and they're ranging out, crossing into Afghanistan to launch attacks, but they're continuing to sponsor other like-minded groups in terms of finances, in terms of training, in terms of specialist Al-Qaeda operatives who will accompany small teams or cells of, say, Pakistanis or Afghans back into Afghanistan to launch a nighttime raid on a paratrooper's forward operating base and then withdraw.
This is quite a picture you're painting. I mean, this raises the kind of prospect that nobody wanted to see in Afghanistan, and we were not led to expect, which is U.S. forces pinned down in the hills under, you know, under fire from troops that come and go across the border. All this has a familiar sound to it that we don't really want to get into. Are U.S. forces cooperating with Pakistan's forces to confront what you describe as Al-Qaeda units or concentrations on the Pakistan side of the border?
Tom, that's a $64 million question. Officially, of course, the Musharraf regime is doing everything it can to assist the US in its ongoing pursuit of al-Qaeda operatives inside Pakistan. However, one can truly question just how genuine that is, particularly among smaller elements, old guard elements of the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI. The even greater problem is the border regions of Pakistan that side along Afghanistan. These are particularly remote. Mm-hmm. These are particularly wild parts of the country. They are fundamentalist to the core. These people are the no-surrender types.
Even in the region where we're told Osama bin Laden may still be sheltered.
It's very, very likely that this is where Osama bin Laden has taken refuge and is now receiving sanctuary.
Michael Ware, let me ask you this. The attacks on U.S. forces along this border, how should we understand them? We see them show up in the newspapers now and then, and it's hard to know what weight to give them. Are these mosquito bites? Are these significant? Could these lead to U.S. troops being withdrawn? You know, is this something that the U.S. military can live with, shrug off, or is this seen as a real serious problem?
It is regarded as a serious problem. In the rest of Afghanistan, U.S. forces are now changing the nature of their operations more towards hearts and minds projects, building schools, doing little tokenistic bits and pieces in the immediate vicinities of their bases. However, along the border regions, they are still completely on a full combat footing. Now, these are mosquito bites for the time being. But as I said, right now, these mosquito bites are coming at such a frequency that they're turning to welts. And if this continues, then one shudders to think where it might lead. For example, not only is the frequency increasing, but the brazenness and the daring, the military effectiveness and the accuracy of these attacks is increasing. I was at a forward operating base with a battalion of American paratroopers on the border with Pakistan not so long ago. Now, while we were there one evening, we came under rocket attack. Now, these rockets are very difficult to operate. They're Type 63 Chinese 107mm rockets. They need an apparatus by which to launch them. That's too heavy to carry, so they lean them on rocks and sandbags and fire them. So they're inaccurate. These ones landed on our perimeter. It was no great problem. Mm-hmm. However, within the last week, that same base has been attacked twice. Both times, the rockets have found their mark. Buildings were damaged inside the American compound. Trucks were destroyed. And in the most recent attack, a paratrooper was seriously wounded in the hand or the arm.
So let me ask you to paint a picture, because the picture that we were all kind of led to expect, the last time the entire country's focus was turned on Afghanistan was, all right, we've got a victory here, and now, and we heard this explicitly, now we're going to dig in, we're going to rebuild this country, it's going to become a bulwark, an example for the rest of the Middle East. These words are still very clear in my memory. And so the picture was kind of a not easy path, and not headed to necessarily riches and, you know, kind of Western affluence, nothing like it, but on a path of stability. If you're correct, if in fact we may see control slipping here, what might the future look like? Paint that picture for us.
Well, let's see. Increasing warlordism. The warlords continue unabated and unfettered, which they currently are now. The American military presence is directed specifically against the terrorists and their supporters and their like-minded individuals. The American military is paying little to no heed to reining in the warlords in the region.
Why does that matter?
Well, you're not going to have a stable Afghanistan until people can go about their daily lives without the threat of warlords, either taxing them on the roads, bursting into their homes, or launching a battle against each other over some turf dispute and ploughing their villages under, killing their families. I mean, for example, Ismail Khan, primarily supported by Iran in the West, has been launching an ongoing campaign against one of his chief rivals, who is an ethnic enemy.
But Michael, bottom line here, the U.S. may not care about this unless it should emerge that Afghanistan once again turns into a terror base.
Is that exactly where it will go? That's exactly where it will go. If Afghanistan falls apart, if you don't rein in these warlords, if you don't give stability, the country will implode. For example, if the US military withdrew today, not only is it likely that President Hamid Karzai would survive more than 24 hours...
You're saying unlikely.
Unlikely. Mm-hmm. But within the shortest matter of time, the training camps would be back. Like I said, they're already just across the border.
And you quote General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying just a couple of weeks ago, we've lost a little momentum there, to be frank. Michael Ware, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about a slipping U.S. grip in Afghanistan. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Yes, evening.
Good evening.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And by the way, I enjoy your show very much.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment and then get your guests' more enlightened opinion on it. You introduced this segment of the show by saying that the U.S. has always been interested in, it was interested in rebuilding and reconstituting Afghanistan.
That's the picture that was painted. That's where we were headed, wasn't it?
I see. And in fact, that statement is always made in the media. And I see no evidence for it. It seems to me that the U.S. behavior in countries that it has intervened in, for example, Haiti, Nicaragua, has been to make sure that the countries are in chaos and then leave them. After a look, as far as controlling terrorists goes, as long as we can send over our bombers and bomb the heck out of it, we don't need a stable Afghanistan.
But, David, that's manifestly untrue, isn't it? During the Clinton administration, we sent cruise missiles in there one after another, and it didn't solve the problem. We had to mount a major campaign to push the Taliban out, to push the Al-Qaeda out. Can we really benefit somehow from chaos in Afghanistan?
Well, it may be a stupid policy, but it seems to me that that it's the policy that's followed. I see no evidence that the U.S. really intends to rebuild. This is what I wanted your guest comment on.
We'll get that. David, thank you for your call. Michael Ware, can you see any interest that serves the U.S. in having chaos in Afghanistan? That is unimaginable to me.
No, it certainly doesn't suit American interests or its agenda for chaos to return.
I mean, we note the pattern that David points out, that we have intervened and left countries one after another, but this one seemed too big, too important. The consequences on 9/11 had been too great to risk a repeat.
You turn your back on Afghanistan, it's going to come back and bite you again. And there has slowly, over the period of this year, been signs of this administration coming to realize that and slowly but surely making, not greater inroads, but heading further down that path. It's very reluctantly. As an American embassy official said to me in Kabul, he said, nation building obviously is a dirty word. It's not one we like to use. Mm-hmm. However, yes, we are now moving towards a position where we are preparing for nation building. However, we have been dragged here kicking and screaming. And look, if you want to build a nation in Afghanistan, the solution is not something that I think the American taxpayer is really going to want to hear.
Why?
It is going to cost billions of dollars. It's going to come over a long, extended period of time, and you're going to have to send not fewer troops to Afghanistan, but you're going to have to send more, and you're going to have to keep them there.
But in spite of all that, I hear you're saying right now that Washington is coming around to the point of view that may be, is necessary.
Absolutely. However, you have to view that shift in policy to what it's going to equate to on the ground. They're still not committing more troops. The aid money that is coming in, whilst it is commendable, whilst it is significant on a certain level, it's a drop in the bucket stuff.
So it's still a high concept, not a reality. Tom's calling from Irvine, California. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm glad that David brought up the topic of Pakistan's involvement, which I thought was missing from the entire media coverage, both on TV and radio. We should not forget that we are not questioning Pakistan's loyalty just as we are questioning Saudi Arabia's loyalty.
Tom, are you saying that the United States should be questioning Pakistan's loyalty?
Yes, because if you remember, USA Today's poll found out that most Pakistanis do not have a favorable opinion of USA amongst all entire Muslim world.
Tom, I want to dive back into that with Michael Ware. Thank you for your call. Michael, what about it? You alluded earlier to this kind of ambivalent position of Pakistan. if, as you say, there are clear al-Qaeda concentrations operating out of Pakistan, operating to such extent that they're firing with regularity on U.S. positions along the border, that would suggest that Pakistan ought to be awfully busy dealing with that. Do we still have this kind of split screen in Pakistan, official support of the U.S. position, but active, unofficial opposition, even support of terror?
Well, I have to be very careful how I answer these questions because I'm in and out of Pakistan all the time. However, I think the evidence might speak for itself. Let's have a look at these border regions where al-Qaeda is taking refuge. They're actually making inroads from these border regions in Pakistan back into Afghanistan, not just in little sorties overnight, but they're crossing the border. For example, al-Qaeda has taken free rein control over a town inside Afghanistan. This is not Pakistan. There is now a place called Angaradar inside Afghanistan that you could loosely describe as al-Qaeda town.
Why don't U.S. troops just go and take care of it? That's
also a very, very complicated answer. I'll tell you primarily why. Because if the U.S. forces drop 600 paratroopers on top of that town, then they're immediately going to be involved in combat with Pakistani troops.
No, I thought you said it was in Afghanistan.
It is. The al-Qaeda forces were able to set up cells and make the use of compounds in this Afghan town because Pakistani Frontier Corps troops moved the border and then on a ridge which separated the town or the marketplace from the nearest Special Forces firebase, they established 8 sandbagged bunkers where they've now placed an artillery piece, 2 anti-aircraft weapons, and according to one American paratrooper officer, each time the Special Forces enter that marketplace now, which I think they've stopped doing, they're fired upon. And on occasion, they've been fired upon from these Pakistani bunkers.
Doesn't sound good. Michael, you described a lot of American soldiers now as being involved in kind of hearts and minds activity. But when U.S. troops go into the villages like you're describing here, what's the reception? What's the interaction with Afghans?
Strained, to say the least. The Afghans will never play their hand, particularly with the way the American forces are conducting their operations at the moment. It is go in with overwhelming force. They know that no one is going to take them on because there's 600 paratroopers, there's close air support, there's Apache helicopters buzzing everywhere, there's mortars, there's artillery. No one is going to mess with that. So the villagers just do what they're told, but they never forget. As the Taliban Deputy Minister for the Interior, a man called Mullah Khaksar, told me recently, no one ever forgets that an American soldier entered your house at night and trawled through women's clothing, albeit looking for hidden weapons. With every one of these operations, he said, don't the Americans realize that their enemy isn't decreasing? Their enemy is increasing as embedded new recruits are created.
Michael Ware, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about a slipping U.S. grip in Afghanistan. How long do you think U.S. troops will need to stay in Afghanistan? Another year? 5 years? 10 years? What would happen if American troops pull out? Do you care? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And the cape.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a slipping U.S. grip in Afghanistan with Michael Ware, Time magazine correspondent, recently returned from a year in Afghanistan, just back 8 or 9 days ago. And we're hearing stories of U.S. soldiers being fired on in forward bases, of al-Qaeda coming in across the border from bases in Pakistan, of U.S. troops making resented forays through Afghan villages. It's not a pretty picture. It's not the picture we were expecting a year ago on the eve of war with Iraq. What can we learn from the aftermath of war in Afghanistan? And what does the Afghan story say about our capacity to clean up terrorist breeding grounds? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Matthew's calling. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hello. My question is, if we had approached this in a more Machiavellian way and not used foreign auxiliary troops, the Northern Alliance, but had used our own soldiers in larger numbers, would we have been more successful? And is this something we should bear in mind for Iraq?
Interesting. Do you see, Michael Ware, a trail today still leading out of the fact that, the U.S. relied heavily on Afghan Northern Alliance soldiers, opponents of the Taliban, for the big campaign last fall and winter? Would it have made a difference? Would there be a difference today if it had been a large number of American troops who had done the fighting then? Would it have been a cleaner slate?
Well, there's a great gnashing of teeth right now within the bowels of the Pentagon over this point. It's clear that that was a grievous error, relying on Afghan proxies. It was a failed strategy.
It kept the fatality rate down. It kept the wounded and dead down among American troops.
That's what I was about to say. The alternative is that America would have had to been prepared to see a lot of body bags coming home. It would have been a very, very difficult campaign. By the same token, too, just the mere presence of American troops perhaps might have made it more difficult. That was one of the great rallying cries of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda before the launch of the ground war. Many of the fresh recruits, these young Talibs who were drawn in at the last minute, who I've come to know and I've interviewed countless of them, they said the great recruiting line that was pitched to them was it come and kill Americans. Now, when they got to the front lines, what they found was Afghan brothers, good Muslims on the other side of the trench. When they didn't see Americans, a lot of the will to fight dissipated. Then, of course, when a devastating bombing campaign began with enormous accuracy, that also robbed them of their will to fight.
But for all that, you're saying that the consequences of this have been negative, have been, in your word, devastating for the U.S. Why was it such an error to rely on Northern Alliance forces, and what are the consequences now? Is it still playing out?
I'll give you one salient example. If the military intelligence is correct, and if the general hubbub in Afghanistan is correct, then it is principally this point, the failure to commit U.S. ground troops in significant enough numbers in the early days, that allowed Osama bin Laden to escape from Tora Bora. Now, that's assuming that he was there. There is some intelligence that is very persuasive to say that, yes, he was. Now, the failure of Tora Bora was simply one thing, and it was the reliance on Afghan proxies.
Our caller Matthew asks about the Iraq parallel. I don't know if you're prepared to look at that, Michael Ware. That's a bit outside the zone you've been working in, but there doesn't seem to be the same reluctance, at least as far as we know, in a potential campaign on Iraq to hold back U.S. forces. There's word of quite large numbers of ground troops being prepared to go in there.
Well, yes. I mean, I think we saw that in 1991, that there was a commitment of significant U.S. ground troops. Now, whether that's a matter of strategy or whether it's simply the fact that where are the opposition troops, the local opposition troups, to rely on?
Yeah.
You've got some in Kurdistan. No, there really is no alternative. If you want to go into Iraq, it's boots and all, or forget it.
John's on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Tom, Mike, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I have a question about the media coverage here. When we initially went into Afghanistan, we could get sights and sounds of everything that was going on. And as everyone knows, we're heavily reliant on the media to get our information. Today, we don't hear anything, and it's very hard for me, and I'm sure everyone else, to understand that we aren't doing the job. So where did the media go?
It almost does feel like a blackout sometimes, doesn't it, John?
Yes, it does.
Thanks for the call, Michael Ware. How about it? Are the reporters simply not there anymore, or has the great roving eye of the American media bosses just moved on to new things, to Iraq?
Well, let's be frank. The news agenda has shifted. If it hadn't shifted before the Iraq issue came back to confront us, then it certainly did once that was upon us. So, yeah, there is a little bit of a black hole there. I mean, just take, for example, the numbers of journalists currently in Kabul. The BBC had a massive compound, two buildings, countless number of staff. They're reduced to one correspondent who, from time to time, doesn't even have a camera. Most of the other major print organisations, except for, with commendable exception, New York Times, Washington Post, and a few others, have all withdrawn. Now, at best, these people parachute in, spend a few weeks, and leave again. It's only a few of us who are still there.
And we note you're now not there, Michael Ware.
Yes, well, I have to come out and recharge some batteries and sit on a beach back in Australia for a little while before I return in January or the latest February.
Mm, fair enough. Feroz is on the line. Welcome, Feroz. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
When I was listening to the program, I've had the opportunity of serving in that area for a couple of years when I was doing my training over there.
In what capacity, Feroz?
I was a trauma surgeon in Peshawar, and as a tour of duty, we had to go across the border to Jalalabad to serve for a little while.
This is in what, in the U.S. Army? In the
Pakistan Army.
In the Pakistan Army, all right.
It was back in 1987 and 88, and that was the last time I was over there.
A while ago, all right.
That is true. And my impression is that what those guys are most afraid of is modern education. I believe the slip on the grip on Afghanistan is going to go to more and more slipping unless it is backed by a massive rehabilitation effort by the U.S. and the international community.
Rehabilitation of people.
Education and the whole infrastructure of the country.
So are you saying in Afghanistan or Pakistan or both? I mean, we have some sway in Afghanistan, much less in Pakistan.
Pakistan is honestly is not that bad, as mm-hmm. bad as the media makes it look like mm-hmm. because of the mullahs who are in control partially in two provinces. But honestly, I don't think it's as bad as the media makes it look like.
But in Afghanistan, we need some different education, Feroz. Thank you for your call. Michael Ware, what about this point? In the schools, to the extent that there are schools, I guess the Taliban curriculum has been thrown out. What's taken its place?
Well, it's not entirely true that the Taliban curriculum has been thrown out.
Great.
Primarily depending on, obviously, where you are. If you're in Kabul, that's relatively the center of light and learning. Kabul is, which is the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul is almost a separate country to the rest of Afghanistan. Remember back in the 70s, during a period of relative enlightenment, you had women in short skirts, you had music, you had a wonderful cafe scene.
I was there, it was great.
I wished I'd been there. That's part of the reason why the fundamentalists gained so much momentum even back then.
It
caused
such
affront to people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, and look, quite frankly, particularly in the south, and I speak with more authority of the south than the north, say, areas around Mazar-e-Sharif, but among the Pashtuns, you know, not a lot has changed in their way of thinking. So schools, say, let's take, for example, Kandahar, there is enrollment has shot back up since the fall of the Taliban.
Boys only?
But girls' enrollment is still only at about 10%. We're lucky if it's at double figures. Mm-hmm. And that is not going to change.
It sounds like there's a lot that's not changing here. Michael Ware, our time is running down, but it's been great talking with you. And I want you to promise to come back and have a new conversation with us after you get a new eyeful after your much-deserved time on an Australian beach.
Tom, it'll be my pleasure, mate.
Thanks so much for coming on tonight. Michael Ware is correspondent with Time Magazine. He's just come back from a year in Afghanistan. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the smallpox vaccination program gets underway. This is On Point. Over the next few days, President Bush is expected to announce the government's first large-scale smallpox vaccination program in more than 20 years. The plan seems all the more urgent after yesterday's report that a renegade Soviet doctor may have sold a strain of smallpox to Iraq. Under the president's plan, military personnel and civilian medical workers will be first in line for the vaccine. Next on the list are first responders, police, firemen, and rescue workers, the first to arrive at an attack scene. The sheriff's office in Orange County, Florida, isn't waiting for the federal government. It's the first law enforcement agency in the country to offer the vaccine to all of its deputies. Inoculated department members will also be encouraged to donate their plasma, which could save the lives of others who suffer side effects from the vaccine. Chief Steve Jones of the Orange County Sheriff's Office got his smallpox shot a few weeks ago. In this radio diary, he explains why his sheriff decided not to wait for the federal smallpox program.
Right now, law enforcement is on the third tier of the plan from the government to initially inoculate everybody, and he thought this would be a great way to get to our law enforcement personnel early on so they can, you know, it's twofold. One, we can give back to the community by donating our blood cells, but also, two, we will be protected. So as first responders, if we have to go to an incident and we get affected, then we cannot be contagious to give it to somebody else. And for me personally, I didn't want to be able to contract smallpox and actually take it home to my 2.5-year-old. So it's protecting me and my family and also the citizens of our community. And it's also a double whammy because we're able to do something for the community. When they do the pre-screener, they're pretty much going through a medical history of everybody, and they take blood from the different people that want to participate. They're able to basically determine or weed out those people that could be adversely affected. They've done 2,300 people in Orange County already, in Central Florida, I'm sorry, and they have not had one person that's had any side effects from this, other than the normal itching for 4 or 5 days after you've had the vaccination. So I had no fear going into it, other than obviously the needle stick, to have that done, because actually, as, you know, as a child, I had it done and I had no problem. And so now when I did it, it was the, you know, the needle stick, and they poke you like 5 or 6 times, and then you have blisters that form later on, and then it scabs over and that falls off, and then that's the end of it. Local law enforcement is always frustrated with the federal government because in our viewpoint, they, you know, don't move fast enough on a lot of fronts. This is a strictly a precautionary thing, but we want to be very proactive and do everything that we can. And I feel like that the more people we can get that are vaccinated with smallpox, the less likely that any terrorist would want to try to do something if they know it's not going to do any good anyway. I never in a million years would have guessed that we'd ever have a problem like this with smallpox. But this is a whole different world. This is a whole different war. I mean, it's serious enough that my sheriff traveled to Israel to learn a lot about firsthand about the car bombings and the different things that are going on over there, because we feel that in light of what happened on 9/11, that a lot of that is going to come to our soil. So we want to be prepared. We want to be proactive. We don't want to just sit back and wait for it to happen. So it's very important for everybody, every citizen, and everybody in law enforcement, everybody to come together and do as much as we can and not wait until it's too late. I just honestly believe from all the intelligence and things you hear in the news that something is going to happen in our country, and I think it's going to continue to happen, because in a free society, there's just no way you can guarantee the safety of everyone.
Steve Jones is a chief in the Sheriff's Department in Orange County, Florida. Orange County is the home to Orlando and 7 other Central Florida cities. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian and Oliver Reed. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...